Welcome to IHPBA Overtime, the latest addition to the IHPBA podcast family. My name is Juliella and I'm the chair of the IHPBA Early Career Group. Before I leave you with our first podcast episode, I wanted to take a moment to introduce this new podcast series. IHPBA Overtime is designed to extend a conversation initiated in the webinars hosted by the Early Career Group of the International Hepatopancreatic Biliary Association. Whether you're just starting your journey in HPB surgery or are well on your way in your surgical career, IHPB Overtime should be an invaluable resource that offers a global perspective about key topics in the practice of HPB surgery. An episode of IHPB Overtime will be released after each IHPBA Early Career Group webinar. So join us as we continue this conversation and explore topics that matter most to early career HPB surgeons worldwide.
All right, well, welcome to our inaugural first ECG Overtime podcast. We're here with two of our esteemed guests from our webinar that we had just a few weeks ago, where the AHPBA meets the IHPBA as part of our early career group series. The title of our webinar was The Dynamic Early Career HPB Surgeon, Tips and Tricks. And we had an excellent hour or so conversation with some early career surgeons who really made a tremendous impact by being dynamic in their practice early on, and it seemed to have been really well received. I want to thank Dr. Kimberly Washington, who is a hepatopancreatobiliary surgeon with Texas Health Physician Group in Fort Worth, Texas, and part of the Health Harris Methodist Hospital, who gave a great talk on setting yourself up for success from a perspective from a community HPB surgeon, as well as Dr. Naruhiko Ikoma from MD Anderson, who gave an excellent talk about, "I didn't learn this in my training, introducing new techniques into your early practice." Thank you all both for being here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Great, thanks. I'm also here with my esteemed colleague and co-host, Gianpaolo Perry, who's joining us from the dead of the night in Italy. Gianpaolo, you want to introduce yourself?
Of course, Tim. Thank you for introducing me. Actually, I graduated in Verona, pancreatic surgery unit in Italy. Then I spent 1 year as a research fellow with you, Tim, and also with Naruhiko at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. It was one of the greatest years in my let's say residency and also early career. And then I went back, I finished my residency, and then also did a clinical fellowship in Karolinska. This is my story up to now. I think I will try to play here the, let's say, devil's advocate for other systems, because you're all practicing in obviously in North America. So I will try to, I don't know, bring some a different point of view to your discussions.
Excellent. Well, without further ado, why don't we get started? And do you mind both Dr. Washington and Dr. Ikoma giving us a summary or rundown of just some important points and concepts that you talked about in your talk? Why don't we start with you, Dr. Washington, which was setting yourself up for success from community HPB surgery perspective.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the podcast. Really appreciate the IHPBA and the HPBA for allowing me to come and speak once again on from the community perspective as a newly trained hepatobiliary surgeon. Dr. Newhook mentioned, I am in Fort Worth, Texas, with the Texas Health Physicians Group at Texas Health Harris Methodist Hospital in Fort Worth, also affiliated with Texas Christian University as an assistant professor there. My talk on the webinar was about setting yourself up for success, particularly in the community environment, and just giving a perspective for the listeners about where or how it would look in order for you to go into practice in a community setting as a hepatobiliary surgeon. And this is something that has somewhat of a some controversy, particularly when it comes to developing a quality program, particularly in a community environment where you don't have some of the resources, particularly when it comes to clinical trial work, but just making the argument that some of those things can be developed in the appropriate community. So On the webinar, just to summarize, some of the points that were made from my talk was that a community practice, the scope and volume can be quite variable, particularly for HPB. There usually is some other that you're doing in addition to HPB. In my sake, I was trained as a general surgeon in practice for 6 years before going back to fellowship in HPB. So I do a small amount of general surgery, whereas some others may have some other type of surgical specialty that they do in addition to HPB in a community. Also, just the importance of having the outpatient support as well as the inpatient components in order to make an effective and safe program for your patients. Some of those outpatient support includes having physician assistants or nurse practitioners as part of your clinic, as well as developing strong relationships with community partners. In our case, these are Cancer Care, United Way, the YMCA that we partner with in order to make sure our patients get some of those support things that may be available in larger university settings that are provided by the university, but we don't have necessarily in our community environment, but our community partners do provide. Also, of course, the inpatient component, having your advanced GI as well as your interventional radiologist is really important, and having clear, easy communication with those departments and those physicians in order to ensure that your patients get the appropriate care. And that, you know, you can develop research opportunities, particularly when, in my case, we're partnering with our basic science faculty at the local university in order to get us more involved in basic science research, as well as looking for opportunities to build clinical trial setups within our community. So all these things will allow us to help allow patients to get access to care without having to travel so far to get to a larger academic institution. So I think these are some of the things. It's a pretty big lift, but this is why we're young and we've got a lot of energy. So it's for us to do, not the old ones.
And certainly dynamic. Absolutely. Dr. Akoma, do you mind giving us a brief summary of what you talked about in the webinar entitled, I Didn't Learn That in My Training, Introducing New Techniques into Your Early Practice?
Of course. Thank you very much again for having me. So a quick introduction of myself. I am originally from Tokyo, Japan. I graduated medical school in Keio University in Tokyo. I did my first surgical training there for 4 years before coming to Houston. I did repeated general surgery residency at University of Texas at Houston. They allowed me to skip 1 year, so I completed in 4 years. And then I applied for the surgical oncology matching, and I was fortunate enough to stay at Houston. And I did a fellowship for 3 years at surgical oncology, complex general surgical oncology program at MD Anderson. And during that 3 year time period, I did 1 year research time, and I took a master's degree in public health. And then that was very fruitful and being productive. And then I was again fortunate enough to stay at MD Anderson as a faculty. And I was tasked to build the robotic surgical oncology practice at MD Anderson. And then the title of the talk was, I Didn't Learn That in My Training. So the focus of my talk was how I strategically build the robotic surgical oncology program at MD Anderson with my colleagues and support. And then how I built the research portfolio around the surgical, the robotic surgery, the technology and technique. And then, how we started the robotic surgical oncology, you know, that as a title at MD Anderson, we, at the time, we didn't have much robotic surgery training or, you know, cases we can learn during the fellowship. So took all, you know, possible approach to learn and gain those skills to start those cases. And then the one thing I considered was very successful was try to combine all possible surgical oncology cases we can do in the robotic surgery. You know, for myself, you know, I focus on pancreas and gastric surgery. And because I thought those organs are anatomically similar to each other in terms of the surgical oncology, surgical approach. So that is the main topic. You know, the point is, in my opinion, we shouldn't do the robotic Whipple before we do the robotic gastrectomy. I hope it makes sense. And then we gain those robotic skills important for those practice synergetically and with the support and tremendous support from senior and the senior colleagues. And then we were able to start those cases for the first 2 years. And then for the last 5 years, we expanded a program with having more robotic surgeons together. And then we have performed more than 400 robotic foregut cases, including almost 200 pancreatectomies and 100 gastrectomy, and there's so many hepatectomy with being done by Tim yourself and also Dr. Trang Cao. And then we have been showing we built the prospective safety monitoring system, and then we reviewed, you know, quarterly to make sure those cases are being performed safely. And then now we are expanding the research programs around that. So in summary, I do have two pillars of research topics. One is, you know, proving the value of the robotic surgery by showing the improvement of the quality of life, reduction in the opioid, and then cost analysis showing the non-increase in the robotic cases for when we compare the to the open surgery by reducing the hospital stay and then reducing the complication rate. The other pillar is innovation. I do have a collaborative research with other engineers and at the University of Texas to develop the fluorescent, the molecular targeted fluorescent agent for the pancreas neuroendocrine tumor, developing the haptics probe in the collaboration with the University of Texas. And I also have industry supporters to do other innovative stuff associated with the robotic surgery. So my advice for younger career surgeons is to have some specific focus in the clinical practice, and as well as in the research programs, and those need to be linked together, obviously. And they always recommend to have, you know, good story of your research progress and research, you know, the career to have a strong statement of what direction you're going to.
I was hoping to start off asking Dr. Washington a question. What did you find were the biggest changes and or challenges that you faced coming from HPB training, which is for the most part an academic setting for most people?
I think the biggest challenge for me was the different politics and that environment that comes along with a hepatobiliary practice as opposed to a general surgery practice. So just to give a little bit of background, as he mentioned, I was general surgery for 6 years out of residency. And I joined a solo practice general surgeon in Texas after residency, at which point basically it was like, you got to build this practice. Like, I'm not going to give you work. You've got to market and get the work. And that actually, you are right, that created somewhat of an unfair advantage when I came back into practice after fellowship, because I knew how to build a practice. I'd already done it once. And so that part, I think, was relatively comfortable because I'd done it once already. The difficult part was that hepatobiliary surgery is a different type of practice, particularly in the community, because you really do have to hold on to the patients that you get. And the reason for that is because, as everyone who's listening to this knows, there's not a ton of patients in comparison to general surgery patients. So pancreas cancers don't happen nearly as commonly as inguinal hernias, right? So your volume, you're picking from a much smaller group of patients, which can create some political difficulty when you're coming into practice. So navigating that was new. And so to me, that was probably the biggest challenge, is coming into an environment where now, you know, where I was before, they didn't have anyone who was solely dedicated to it, but they did have general surgeons who were doing a lot of this work, kind of piecemeal. And then I showed up and tried to organize it into one funnel. And that created, obviously, some political element to it that was new. So navigating that was definitely a challenge. The other element that was pretty challenging was, previously in general surgery practice, I didn't have to build a program. So I didn't have to get our interventional radiologists on one page. I didn't have to ensure prior to coming in that our interventional radiologists were comfortable doing the things that I would ultimately need them to do. The same thing is true regarding having our advanced GIs on board with the things that I would need. And so arranging all of those things as well was a new experience. And so that created a different type of challenge. But from the practice standpoint, that part was very comfortable because I had done that already. So that part was an unfair advantage, as you call it. But the interpersonal interactions and building the program has definitely been a challenge for me, and one that I welcomed. It was a new way of practicing. It encouraged me to use some other qualities that I didn't need to use previously in practice that now I have to employ. So definitely was a challenge and certainly welcomed.
Well, to elaborate on that case, but what did you find for qualities or tactics, you know, tips that you can give early career surgeons who might be finding the same thing to ensure quality and build the practice as successfully as you have?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing I've learned so far, or at least a technique that worked for me coming into this environment that was, different in that way, was that I approached it as initially I'm coming in out of training. Anything that you get that is more complex or more... Sometimes the disasters that you don't want to deal with, I'm happy to deal with them, you know? And so I had to be available for kind of those disaster patients, particularly the one that I can think of most readily are the necrotizing pancreatitis patients. No one wants those patients. And so if I'm willing to take care of those patients and give them good quality care, that has won over several general surgeons who now have decided that they no longer need to do pancreas anymore because I'm here. And so just being willing to take care of some of the things that they don't want to deal with has been a really good way of gaining their support for some of the things that they previously managed that now they feel that they can just hand over. So that worked really well. The other element with building the program and the interpersonal elements that come along with that between departments is, identifying different physicians who actually want to grow their scope, particularly the advanced GIs who want to do more complex things. And I've been successful at finding a couple of those. And so I stretched them a little bit. Like I asked them to do some things that maybe they haven't done since training or, you know, that they're excited to do, you know? And so it helps us build together, even though they've been in practice longer than I have. Same thing for the interventional radiologists. You know, we recently got a spyglass for them. They love it. They are the most excited about putting a spyglass down a PTBD. Okay. And so I am like using them as much as possible because they're super excited about it. So those sorts of things can encourage excitement in them, which can then help me when I'm growing this practice. So those were some of the ways that I have kind of garnered a bit of support in the community for the HPB program.
I would have a follow-up question on this for Dr. Washington. How do you balance, if you have advice about balancing, this urge to take on all the cases and at the same time, I think the necessity sometimes to select at the beginning of your practice the patients according to your skills. I mean, did you find any useful tips to give other early career surgeons about this?
Yeah, I think that actually that came a lot easier after being in practice for several years, because I made mistakes initially coming into general surgery practice of taking on cases that were a little too advanced for where I was in my experience at that time. And so I felt the pains of dealing with complications from cases that I did that were a bit too advanced. And I think that was more experience. So coming back into practice, it was a bit easier to identify, like, that one might be a little too much. I may need to send that somewhere else, because I had already dealt with some of the mistakes, I guess you could say, in my general surgery practice. So I was a bit more cautious. I think the biggest recommendation is always identify who can help you, like know who that is before you go into the case. And that was one of the things I did at my interview here, was to make sure that the support systems that were in place that I could foster, I already met at the interview. So our vascular surgeons, I made sure I met with them before I started. And I wanted to know what was their experience. They were much older. I knew they were experienced. I knew they had done this stuff in the past, but I wanted to know their experience and if they were willing. The same thing to have, we had a transplant surgeon also who had quite a bit of experience as well, and just making sure that they were going to be available to me if I called. Same is true of our trauma surgeons. Even though they don't do HPB, they're experienced hands who can help you when bleeding happens. And they're always there. They're there 24 hours. It's a level one center. So would they be receptive to those sorts of things? And so I think that's the first thing, is making sure you know who your support system is. And then the second is to leave your ego at the door. And I learned that the hard way in general surgery practice, was that sometimes you may need to let it go. Like, let someone else do that. Year one. I think the biggest recommendation, or the best recommendation I got prior to coming back into practice, was that your first year to 2 years, you need to keep your complications very low. Like, everyone in your community needs to know that you are a safe surgeon. And I got that recommendation a few years in the general surgery practice, and then I heard it again at the end of fellowship. And I think that was probably the best recommendation. I'm just over a year in now. My complication rate has been very low, and people trust me, and that's exactly where I want them. I've got them where I want them now, but I want them to know that I'm safe and I make safe decisions and I'm a safe surgeon. And then over time, I can become a bit more, I can start doing some of the more complex things. But I think that's that was a great recommendation that I heard twice in my career, and certainly took heed of it.
So we could say also monitoring outcomes is really important, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we have a coordinator who's a non-clinical nurse practitioner, and her whole role is to monitor outcomes of this program and make sure that the program is developing appropriately. And they hired her a year or so before I started. So this was all part of the plan.
Great. So Dr. Akoma, just to talk more about starting this robotic program, of which I'm a very small piece, and it's been quite inspiring to watch firsthand. What did you find were the biggest challenges with bringing a new technique to what is already a obviously a very established practice? Number one. And number two, did you feel any pressure, or was any pressure placed upon you? I actually don't know the answer to this, to replicate a certain level of quality with this new technique that is already an established program?
Yeah, that is a great question. So first, the challenge, you know, honestly, I feel very fortunate, you know, doing this work at MD Anderson, because, you know, I know everybody, and then everybody knows me, and then that was a great start. And the thing I always tell fellows, you know, when they're starting the robotic practice, I always tell them that you know, you don't need a robotic surgeon as your collaborator, but you need to have a senior colleagues who is supporting you, you know, holding my back. And so in terms of that, I do have Dr. Katz for the pancreas surgery and Dr. Baggio from the gastric surgery team. And I was fully supported, and as you know, and then that was, I feel very fortunate. And then what I try to do, you know, I'm still trying to do that now too, is very, you know, being transparent for what is happening, you know, in the OR for robotic cases. And it is in general very easy to be criticized if something, you know, wrong happens when we are implementing the newer technology, right? There's a very easy to find somebody to, you know, who doesn't like those, you know, innovations. And then, and something, you know, stupid happened in my early experience. Like, this is a great example, I think. You know, I placed, you know, OG2 for during the distal pancreatectomy. And then for to get better exposure, I do what I call the external retraction. I put the figure of eight stitch on the stomach, and using the Carter Thompson to pull the stomach from outside to have, you know, stomach being retracted up. Then we can free up one of the arm free for other part of the operation to get exposure. And then one patient, you know, after successful distal pancreatectomy, patient is awake, and I asked them to remove the OG tube. And then I was called back to the OR, hey, OG tube is not coming out. And I immediately knew, you know, my stitch went through the hole of the tip of the OG tube. And then, you know, for that patient, I asked them to give some more. I think we intubated again. We didn't need to, you know, go back to, into the abdomen again, but I used the EGD and then cut the suture from the inside. But exactly what was happening, you know, the suture I made to the stomach was going through the tip of the OG tube. And then that is, you know, it was nothing serious, but it's something, you know, stupid. And I'm open for criticism. So for that case, I immediately send an email to everybody. Hey, this stupid thing happened in this OR. For the next case, I will definitely ask to remove the OG tube before we extubate the patient. And then I presented that at M&M. And when we try to be transparent like this, no one is going to criticize me. And the worst thing can happen, you know, the worst criticism happens when we try to hide things from other surgeons. And then that is very easy to lose the trust from other surgeons. So, you know, because I was able to do that because I know everybody is supporting me. If you're in the different environment, you may, you know, I may think I want to, you know, hide that kind of stupid thing. You know, that's not the complication. It's easy to say that. So, you know, I know people are supporting me. I know I trust them. So that was a good start for me because I knew the culture here.
But no matter where you are in practice, yeah, there's always going to be someone in the back who's like, see, I told you that whole robot thing was a dumb idea.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like, missing the whole point. But anyways, the second question was, did you feel any pressure?
Oh, yeah.
Or any pressure applied to replicate, at least in short order, a certain quality metric or quality product of what is already an established, you know, high level of quality, at least reputationally at a place like MD Anderson?
Yeah, I think that's very important. You know, I think the strategy, how to build the robotic practice for anything is the first important to know the culture of that place. At MD Anderson, as you know, Tim, you know, we have a very traditional approach for many different, you know, surgery being done at MD Anderson, in particular in pancreatectomy and gastrectomy. Dr. Katz is very, you know, strong, has a very strong opinion to do the periadventitial SMA dissection, which may not be, you know, the case at other institutions. Similarly for the gastrectomy, Dr. Baggio is strongly think about the D2 lymph node dissection. Those are the what we believe, you know, the important the quality of surgical oncology procedure being done in Janssen. In this situation, I definitely didn't want to cut the corner for those important the oncological quality of surgery. And then we definitely made a strategy to achieve those goals by, you know, maintain the what we believe important for the oncological surgery, and while we also maintain the safety of the operation. That was, you know, primary goal. You know, I didn't feel the pressure, but I consider that is the primary goal of when we build in the robotic surgical oncology practice.
I'd like to ask Dr. Ikoma his point of view regarding also getting involved into robotic surgery, but maybe in a setting that's a little different from the one you know, described in your talk. In other words, let's say in this case the resources are a bit more limited, so maybe there is only one robot in and only for specific weekdays, and maybe only, let's say, a more senior surgeon is now using it, and maybe just for Whipple, so not small procedures because there's not much access. I would like to know, in your opinion, in this scenario, let's say waiting for your time to shine in the robot, what's useful, what's the tip for some early career student that is still interested into robotic surgery, you want to be part of it, but still doesn't have the resources right now. So I don't know, maybe assisting table side, doing courses, fellowships, or simulator, laparoscopy, I don't know. If you have any kind of advice in this particular setting, and it's quite common, I think, worldwide.
Yeah, that's a challenge. You know, similar situation in Eastern Asian country like Korea and Japan. There's a hierarchy to the access to the robot, and then experienced surgeon still wants to learn those robotic surgical oncology cases, and then it's difficult for younger surgeons to gain those you know, exposure or access to the complex robotic cases. You know, probably approach is gonna be differ depending on those institution. And I believe, you know, first convince your, you know, senior, you know, leader who has a power to allocate those, you know, access or effort to younger surgeon, because that is critically important for younger surgeon to have a earlier exposure. And in my opinion, you know, I always tell this, but like, for example, I grew up with Nintendo. You know, I'm very familiar with how to control things with the, you know, controller. And the older generation did not have that. So, you know, the robotic surgery is designed more, you know, favorable or easier for younger surgeon to control. And in this, you know, the perspective, you know, our young, even my kids, you know, kids are doing like a totally different, more advanced controllers when they're doing the video games. So I consider that the future robots probably going to have different design, which we, our generation may not even to use it. So the point is, those leadership in the hospital need to consider robots are more, you know, better fit for younger generation. They need to consider those program development is relying on the younger generation like you, and then have secure your, you know, consistent access to the robot. And then what I like to say is that don't jump on the robotic Whipple from the beginning, but you probably need to start with the robotic cholecystectomy, robotic gastrogeginosomy, to gain as much exposure as possible you can, and and then do those cases safely. And then over time, you know, gradually, you know, increase the complexity of the cases, you know, the distal gastrectomy before doing the total gastrectomy. You know, for example, we did about, you know, 50 robotic, you know, such other cases before we start the robotic Whipple. And those kind of strategic building is important. And then convince those administrator or leaders to allow you to have a better access to the robot. And of course, those simulators, you know, courses, cadaver courses, those are critical, you know, get the maximum, you know, the use of that.
I do have a question, just as also as an HPV surgeon, you know, I've come to watch you at MD Anderson once already, and it was awesome. But how do, I guess, what recommendation do you have for a surgeon like myself where, you know, in your situation, you had a senior partner who was available and supported the initiation of this program. But in my circumstance, is it, would it be safe even to attempt to learn this technique or employ this technique when you don't have that? And if it is safe or you think it would be, then what's the ideal first patient for that?
I consider it safe as long as you have a strategy to achieve your goal. You know, that depending on the complexity, how much you want to go to, you know, I think it is totally reasonable, you know, say I'm not going to do robotic Whipple because that is, you know, very advanced cases, you know, definitely not for everybody. But at the same time, you know, for cases like, I understand there's a hesitancy for us to use a robot for cholecystectomy, for example, but that is also, you know, good case in my opinion, to learn the robotic dissection, you know, gallbladder off the gallbladder, you know, the liver. Robotic gastrojejunostomy for the palliation, that is also a great case for you to use how to manipulate small bowel, do the stapler, and close the open enterotomy by suturing. Those are great cases. And a robotic distal gastrectomy, my favorite case, the same thing, it's a relatively straightforward case, but you know, you need to learn the skill, how to gently maneuver those small bowel and reconstruction and those kind of stuff. And then after that, you just slowly, you know, they increase the complexity over time as much as you feel comfortable. And don't hesitate to convert to open whenever you feel struggle. You know, in my opinion, it is all about time efficiency when you're doing the complex robotic cases. If you can do the open Whipple in 5 hours, probably it's not much benefit for the patient to have a, you know, 13-hour robotic Whipple. You know, the time is also important. So you know, if you see a lot of adhesion or pancreatitis, having the difficulty to make a progress, and just, you know, convert to open, you know, at the earlier stage rather than, you know, get into 10 hours of operation. So yeah, it's, you know, building your comfort level, you know, over time. And then again, it's totally reasonable, you know, going to say I'm not going to do Whipple, but I'm going to do robotic gastrectomy or distal pancreatectomy. And I see great benefit of the robotic approach for those cases.
I have a question for Dr. Washington, but I really quickly want to just take Dr. Akoma's conversation to another point here, which is what I've identified, and you talked about this in the webinar, and I think I asked you a question about this in the webinar as well, just to highlight the different approaches to bringing a new technique, you know, being a dynamic junior surgeon, early career surgeon with these things. I feel like from a 30,000 foot view, there's two ways to do this sort of thing. There's I'm a robotic surgeon at all costs and try to do everything that comes your way robotically, or stick to a foundational, you know, approach of open surgery and build steps to what your goal is through different cases robotically. And I think that you've done the latter, and I've seen you build all the steps towards a robotic Whipple. You do in other operations exactly the same way every time, so that now all of your cases are all tied to your, you know, in themselves. So you can you comment on that? Like, is it pieces of the puzzle or just be a robotic surgeon with the whole puzzle from the very beginning?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the robotic, I think it's combination of first, you know, doing the robotic Whipple, for example, is applying your robotic skills to what you do in an open Whipple procedure. So in my opinion, if you cannot, you're not comfortable doing the open Whipple procedures, you know, doing the robotic Whipple is not a good idea, obviously. And then many of the upper GI surgery procedures have a kind of shared, you know, skills. For example, when I do the robotic esophagogastrostomy. The technique I do is exactly the same when I'm doing the hepatic jejunostomy. So that is a great example of the similarity between those pancreatectomy and gastrectomy. And then, you know, that kind of suturing technique is coming from my, you know, robotic gastrojejunostomy, you know, suturing as well. So you will, you know, find many different, you know, surgery skill. You know, same thing in a, you know, open approach, you know, there's a certain skills that can be applied to many different operations. And so I like to say, you know, we need to have a commitment, particularly during the learning curve, to focus on, you know, building the robotic skills as much as you can do by doing the many cases, starting from the easy cases. And those skills accumulate in your skill sets. And then you will have a different way of thinking how to approach those complex cases. And then I love this Dr. Katz word in saying that, you know, all operation have to be done in your head before going to the surgery. So, and then we can prepare for those complex cases in advance and then thinking ahead, you know, how we should approach for those individual cases. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, is there still some time? I have a really, really simple, maybe stupid question for both our speakers, but taking your early career until now, let's say, what would you change? I mean, there's something you regret or you would change or you're not satisfied with.
Probably the biggest thing that I would have done differently coming into this particular practice is I probably would have had a better grasp on the paperwork side of like from my residence, from my fellowship. So in fellowship, all of these epic notes were templated and they were done. And I did not save them all before I left. So that was probably an efficiency move I should have done. I got some of them, but not all of them. And so if there was something that probably would have saved me, you know, a few weekends on my computer, on my couch, trying to reproduce those things, that's one of the things I probably would have done differently. I think the only other thing is that I didn't meet with some of the elements that I would need later before I got here. So there were a few different departments that I should have made sure that I met with, and I didn't. And it didn't cause any problems, but it slowed things down, I think, a bit when I arrived. And I probably should have been more thoughtful about who all I needed to meet before I arrived. One in particular, which seems somewhat distant, was our radiation oncologist. So I didn't meet with them before. And I think it would have helped some of the, just for us to have some conversations about their perspective on certain treatment things before arriving. It just would have been nice to know them and for them to know me before they saw me on the first tumor board. And I came with a particular way that I thought things should be done. So it may have smoothed that over a little bit, but those were probably the major things that I would have done differently.
Yeah, I have one thing. Tim, do you remember, you know, I invited you to the dinner a couple of days ago, you know, for the Halloween night, and then you declined the offer because it's Halloween. You know, yeah. We had the grand speaker, we had a dinner. You know, that the speaker is from Korea and it's one of my collaborators, so it's very important for me to have him and attend the dinner. So then, you know, a few other surgeons also declined because it's Halloween night. And as you know, I have four kids. So I felt sorry and I went to, you know, my wife, hey, Yoko, I'm sorry. I know it's Halloween. And then, but Dr. Kim is a very important person. I have to host this dinner. I really cannot miss it. My wife was like, what are you talking about? And then for the last 12 years, you made to Halloween only one time. don't make it sound like you were being always there. So, you know, I probably should have spent more time with family, particularly at the Halloween night. That's my mistake.
Well, that is my fault. And I'm totally listening on a podcast because I literally don't know what the next date is until it's the day before. So if I were to say that, what, you know, answer that question, it's on a similar vein, and it may, you know, me personally would be maybe too much all at once, too fast. And we all, I think it's important to grow at our own pace, mature at our own pace, gain experience at our own pace, because we're all trying to be safe, dynamic surgeons, obviously. But it's really easy to like build anxiety that you don't need, that can distract from the important things when you have getting pulled in all directions, when you're not necessarily well equipped to handle all those things at once yet. And I think that for me, that was something I certainly felt and continue to feel. And I think that's part of, we all have that sort of thing, and it's, we all have that struggle. But you know, if we had Dr. Wilson on the webinar as well, who's not with us tonight, who talked about the importance of saying no and feeling pressure about whether being able to say no. And I don't know if necessarily saying no is the, we always use that question when we talk about these things. I don't know if saying no is really what it's about. It's about, you know, learning to be efficient with your time.
Yeah. And can I comment that? That is a really good comment. And then, you know, I think, you know, the first 5 years as a faculty is just a time for you to have, you know, your priorities. And then my favorite word Dr. Katz also mentioned is that the strategy is all about priority. Mm-hmm. And then also you will, you know, I, you know, learned so much in the first 5 years about what is important to me. And then obviously we all have a different, you know, passion, different pathway. And then initially, you know, like you said, I kind of struggled and feel pressure to go to those conferences, you know, alliances and those, you know, the societies, committees, that's a lot of work. And then, you know, Tim, you've been doing wonderful in the leadership at this HPBA, you know, this is a great example for your success. And then, but for me, it's, you know, I found that I'm not, you know, first, not good at it. And the second, I probably more enjoy my own research done, you know, being a committee member. So those value is very important. And then what you want to, you know, spend more time on, you know, the different things, you know, it depends on the individual, you know, the preference. So, you know, I finally kind of, it took for me to have a 5 years to identify what I really want to do and what I really want to spend time on. And then after figuring it out, I feel more, you know, ease or relax, and then, you know, by, you know, clarifying what the goals are.
Yeah, the importance of, you know, it's really important to build, try to build, we're all trying to build a motif and stick to the motif. And that's what inspires us and we're passionate about. It's really hard to do that effectively if you're allowing yourself to be pulled in many other extraneous directions. And some of that is required, some of that is citizenship, some of that is important to the team, right? Not even something bigger than yourself, but I found that to be the hardest.